Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 16th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Conclusion of the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 7:13 through 29 with personal reflection, presented by John Leonard. Session number LEJ 2005-05. Let's listen in.
And then I'm going to read a personal reflection, if that's all right. I haven't read this before here before. The sermon begins with happy words. Blessed are those, blessed are those, blessed are those, blessed are those, you know, the eight Beatitudes. And then it ends somewhat harsh. It talks about the road is hard, false prophets, self-deception. And I think it's important for us to hear both. Not just to hear the blessed, 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 but also to hear the words about the narrow gate and so forth. So I'd like to begin by reading the narrow gate. Enter through the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the road is easy that leads to destruction. And there are many who take it. For the gate is narrow and the road is hard that leads to life, and there are few who find it. That's not a real happy passage there, is it? Not a real happy passage. The narrow gate. You'll notice that I have a strange shirt on. I haven't worn this here on purpose. I wanted to wear it for today. It's got Zambia, Malawi, can't remember that word, today, Jesuits. And then it has what you and I would call IHS, but it's really Iota, Eta, Sigma, which is Jesus, the first three words of Jesus in Greek, across. And I was in the Jesuits for 17 years. And the first 7 years are training, 2 years novitiate, 2 years classical studies, 3 years philosophy. And I mentioned in one of the talks that I majored in history during the philosophy time besides taking philosophy. And one of the teachers I had was a man we called Doc Davis. He was an old Jesuit priest. And he got me to read a book on Africa. And then I just fell in love with Africa. And so at that point, the Oregon province, which is Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana, and Alaska, decided they would help out in northern Rhodesia. And I was just about ready to go with what they call regency. And regency is 3 years of teaching, and then you come back and do 4 years of theology. It's a long training. And so I wrote to the provincial, even before we had the mission there, and wrote and wrote and wrote. And so then when it was time for me to go to regency, I was the first, me and another guy from Gonzaga Prep and School Camp, were the first scholastics to go to northern Rhodesia. And I went with a priest named Father Jack O'Leary. Well, got there in 62, and then in the beginning of 63, they sent Jack and me up to language school in the northern province. And we went 400 miles on a bus, and it took 2 days. So we went one day, and then there was coming a rest stop or something after 200 miles. And got up to this language school, and what I found interesting about the language school was not only Chibemba, which I remember very little about, Mwakolani Mukwai, saying hello to you, but they also taught African customs. And the African custom that intrigued me was that boys and girls, when they got to puberty, would go through an initiation rite. And they had to succeed in going through the initiation rite, or they weren't a man or a woman. So they'd have to come back and take the test over again if they failed. You follow me? So, about the road being narrow, I have a story that takes place that concerns an initiation rite. There was a young man named Kapate, and Kapate was very, very good person, and he listened to all the training. It went through the training camp, and then it came time for the elder to say, now this is your test. So the test was this: take neither water nor food. Go out on your own. Find a lion. Look the lion in the eye and let the lion look you in the eye. Find a boa constrictor. Look the boa in the eye and let it look you in the eye. And find an elephant. Look the elephant in the eye and have the elephant look you in the eye. So Kapate started off, and he decided, well, I'm going to start with the hardest and then get down to the elephant. The elephants are all over the place, and they're so big you can't miss them. So he said, here's what I'll do. I'll go for the lion first. So he knew the time to find a lion was when a lion had just eaten, because when lions eat, then they take a siesta, sort of like me. And so he went along, he saw carcasses, and then he found this lion who was kind of sleeping. And he went up to the lion, and he knew the lion didn't have a lot of energy after eating, and it kind of went. And the lion raised its head, and he looked the lion in the eye, and the lion looked him in the eye. One down, two to go. So the next animal to find was the boa constrictor. Now, they can be very dangerous, but they're not real quick. So he figured the problem was going to be finding the snake. So he found the snake, and he got within distance of the snake, and then he looked the snake in the eye, and the snake looked him in the eye, and he passed on. Third one to go, the elephant. He saw elephant droppings everywhere. He saw branches off trees, because they tear the branches off the trees at times. He found down branches. He knew they were around, and so he looked and he looked and he looked, but he couldn't find the elephant. And he looked and he looked and he looked, and he still couldn't find the elephant. And he looked and he looked and he looked, and he was really, really thirsty. And he was really, really hungry. And he decided, I'm just going to fall apart if I don't find the elephant right now. I'm going to have to go back and take the test next year. Well, he decided, I better go back. So he went back to the village, and he ate, and he drank, and he drank, and he drank, and he drank. Then the elder called him in, and he said, okay, now tell me what happened. So he talked about going out and finding the lion when it was just kind of coming off a siesta and looking it in the eyes. One down. And I looked for the boa, and I finally found a boa, and I looked it in the eyes, and it looked me in the eyes. Two down. And then Kapate kind of looked at the chief, and he said, but I never found an elephant. I saw all kinds of signs of elephants, but I never found an elephant. So I have to wait till next year to become a man. And when he said that he had to wait till next year to become a man, the chief rose, and the chief said to him, oh no, you passed the test. We drove all the elephants out of the area. The real test was to fail and then to have the courage to come back and tell the truth. You are a son of the tribe. Isn't that a great story?
Yeah.
Great story. So that's, now Carrie told me I'm supposed to pass out the pictures at the beginning here, because then she wants to hold them and not show them to anybody else so she can look at them. But the first story is on the bottom, and there are two stories here, the story of the three trees and the story of the initiation rite. So the road is narrow. I think Kapate is an excellent example of someone who finds the road and follows it. Next section in this last part of the sermon. Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves. You will know them by their fruits. Are grapes gathered from thorns or figs from thistles? In the same way, every good tree bears good fruit, But the bad tree bears bad fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus you will know them by their fruits.
What verse are you on?
That's verses 15 to 20, chapter 7. A tree and its fruits. A good tree bears good fruits. One time there was a woman whose husband had died and she had three daughters, and they lived in the woods. Let me see which one of these is bearing good fruits here. And she worked in town, and so she would come home and she wanted to make sure that the daughters knew that she was coming, because she didn't want them out because it was dangerous out there. They were wild animals. So she would come home, and before she'd get them to come out, she would go, "One, my daughter, come to mama. Two, my daughter, come to mama. Stay, Philomandra, stay. Stay where you are." And the two daughters would run out and throw their arms around mama, and Philomandra would stay in the hut. And then the daughters and mom would cook dinner, and they'd have dinner, and then whatever was left over, they'd bring in for Philomandra. This went on for years and years, and poor Philomandra was just left out. Well, there was a wolf that was watching all of this, and the wolf decided that if it could imitate the mother's song, then the daughters would come out and it would have two delicious things to eat, keep it fed for a long time. So one time, just before the mom came home, and the wolf was very clever, it knew when mom came home, so about half an hour before mom would come home, it decided, "I'm going to try and sing the song." So the wolf went out there and went, "One, my daughter, come to mama. Two, my daughter, come to mama. Stay, Philomandra, stay. Stay where you are." And the girls didn't come out. And then he thought about it, and he decided, maybe my voice was too low. Maybe I got to try and get my pitch higher. So he worked on getting his pitch higher, and then a week or two later, he came back, and he went, "One, my daughter, come to mama. Two, my daughter, come to mama. Stay, Philomandra, stay. Stay where you are." And the two daughters went running out, and the wolf grabbed him, tore him off to his lair. And when the mother came home and saw the door was open, and she knew that the two daughters were gone, she just broke down and cried and cried and cried and ran away. Well, who's that lead? Philomandra. So Philomandra finally came out, and she looked around, and she didn't see her sisters, and she didn't see her mother, and she was hungry. So Philomandra saw the road, and she followed the road, and followed the road, and followed the road, and she came into the village. And when she got to the village, she smelled this delicious smell. Oh, it smelled so good. It was a bakery. So she went to the bakery, and she said, "Boy, that smells good. Do you have food?" And they said, "Yes, we have food." And she said, "Can I have some?" "Well, do you have any money?" "No, I don't have any money. I'm all by myself." "Well, you can have food, and then you can stay here and work with us." So she ate there, and then she became part of the baking crew at the bakery. And she grew older and became a very, very good baker. And after a while, the king decided that this bakery was so good that he wanted them to be the royal bakers. And so he brought them into his palace. So when he brought them into his palace, Philomandra went with them. And she'd bake in the kitchen in the palace, and every now and then the prince would come down, and the prince obviously was interested in Philomandra. Aha, she was a nice-looking woman. So she'd come down, and he'd try and help stuff, and after a while, they decided to get married. So then she became the princess, as it were. And then the king died and she became queen. But she didn't forget her lowly beginnings when she became queen, so she would go down and help out in the bakery one time, at least once a week. And then one day, the baker said, Philomandra, there's a strange woman that comes every now and then to the door, and she just looks awful, and we don't know who she is, and she just sort of comes, and we give her something to eat, and then she goes away. And Philomander says, next time she comes, call me. So the next time this woman came, they went up and got Philomander, and she came down, and she looked out, and there was this ugly old woman bent over, and she was mumbling, and Philomander kind of listened to the mumbling, and the woman kind of, and she recognized the song that her mother used to sing. And she realized that this old woman was her mother. So Philomandra took her in and fed her and loved her back into beauty. That's the story of Philomandra. Someone who has been hurt by others and yet can forgive others and welcome them into her heart. By their fruits you shall know them, it says in that passage. Now I find it interesting that when St. Paul talks about the fruits of the Spirit, love is always number one. He talks about it in Galatians and in Corinthians, 1 Corinthians. But he does not mention forgiveness as one of the fruits of the Spirit. And yet you and I know that to be really loving, we have to learn how to forgive. When I was a kid, my mom and my dad were alcoholics. And I had the ability to kind of love them, but boy, I couldn't forgive them. I couldn't forgive them. And then when I became older, and found out I was an alcoholic myself and went to treatment. Mom had died already, but Dad lived into his 80s. Then I realized that I could forgive because I understood that alcoholism was a disease and I'd been inflicted with it. And actually I'd been able to overcome the disease in the sense of I didn't have any trouble not drinking once I went to treatment. But Dad was in and out of treatment, in and out of treatment, in and out of treatment. Finally, it caught. And when he was very old, because he was kicked out of a couple of places where he was living because of his drinking. And I used to go to Dad, and I had forgiven him, and I would always say to Dad, Dad, I love you. And my dad would always say to me, thank you, John. Not once do I remember my father ever saying to me, I love you. He could say it to my sister, but he could not say it to me because I think he was trained in a fashion that you don't say, I love you, to another man. And so when I had children of my own, I say all the time, I love you, and my son says to me, I love you too, Dad. In fact, he may start it off that way. So, you know, forgiveness is hard, and being able to get through that thing is kind of hard. Sometimes we strive to hear certain, or to bear certain fruits, and other fruits come. There's a story that's actually a little book, and it's a beautiful story, and it's the other illustration on that chapter, the story of the three trees. Once upon a time, there were three trees growing up in the woods. And they grew and they grew and they grew and they loved to communicate with each other. They used to love to talk to each other. And they loved to talk about their dreams. Oh, their dreams. Now, this story is about becoming more than you dreamt about. And the first tree said, when I am cut down, and I know I'll be cut down, I want to be a treasure box. I want to hold gold and silver and diamonds. That's what I want to be. And the second tree, which could see the ocean in the distance, would say, when I am cut down, I want to become an ocean-going liner. And I want to carry people from one side of the ocean to the other side of the ocean. One side of the ocean to the other side of the ocean. And the third tree said, I don't want to be cut down. I want to become the tallest tree in the forest. And when people look at me and look up and up and up and up and up and up, I want them to see that I point to God. So they kept sharing their dreams, sharing their dreams. And then one day, woodcutters came into the forest. And they came to the first tree and they chopped it down. And the first tree thought, I'm going to become a treasure box. And they came to the second tree and they chopped it down. And the second tree said, I'm going to become an ocean-going liner. And the third tree was panicking because it didn't want to be cut down. It had to be the tallest tree. It had to point to God. That's what it wanted to do. And he heard the guy with the axe say, any tree will do for me. And he chopped down the third tree. And as the third tree fell, it knew that it had lost all its hopes. Well, the first tree was taken off and brought into a place, and it kept its eyes closed because it didn't want to see what it was until after they made it into what it was going to become, a treasure box. And so kept its eyes closed, and it felt itself being worked on and worked on and worked on, and then it felt itself being picked up and taken away, and figured, I am a treasure box. But it still kept its eyes closed. And then finally, it opened its eyes and they saw that they had put him in a cave and there wasn't a treasure box. It was a feeding trough for animals. And it thought, oh my gosh, my dreams are over. The second tree went into a place that made boats. It saw that on the way, so it decided, I'm going to close my eyes and see what I become, what kind of ocean liner I become. So it waited while they put the whole thing together, and then they took it out and they put it in water, and it said, I'm in the ocean. And it opened its eyes, and it was in a lake, and it became a fishing boat. And it knew it would smell and smell and smell. And the third tree, whose hopes had been dashed already, was just chopped up, made into lumber, and stuck in a woodyard. Well, the first tree, the one that was the feeding trough, one day it was in its cave and it smelled because of the animal stuff around it. And a young couple came in and the woman gave birth. And the husband cleaned out the trough and put fresh straw in it. And they picked up the newborn and put it in the feeding trough so that the feeding trough became kind of a crib. And all of a sudden, the first tree realized, I'm much better than a treasure box. I'm holding someone very, very, very important. And the second tree, much later on, was out on the waters, and someone was sleeping in the back, and the fishermen were fishing, and a storm came up and it started going, bah, 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 and the people cried out, save us, save us, save us. And the man in the back woke up and he calmed the waters. And the second tree realized, I'm much better than I thought I would be. I'm holding someone with so much power. This is a lot better than being an ocean liner. And the third tree stayed in the lumberyard until one day it was taken out and shaped into a thing like a T, and then carried by this man and another man up to this hill and put in the hill, or put someone was nailed to him and put in the hill and stood up there. And then they took the man down, and it stood up there. And as it stood there, it realized that the man they took down was very, very special. And a couple days later, the tree realized he is really, really special. And then the tree realized it was pointing to God in a way far, far, far better than being the tallest tree in the forest. Story of three trees, three hopes, hopes diminished, hopes thwarted, hopes fulfilled in ways they never could have dreamed that they would be filled. The next section of this chapter is on self-deception. Huh. So this is verses 21 to 23. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father in heaven. On that day, many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do many deeds of power in your name? Then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Go away from me, you evildoers. Self-deception. There once was a missionary in Africa who loved art, and he decided that someday in his homily he would use art to show the Africans what he meant. And this one day he was preaching about hell, and he had this really, really powerful picture about these people burning in hell. And so he decided that when he gave his sermon, then he would pull out the art and show it to the people, and that would really, really impress them about how bad hell was. So he gave his sermon on hell, and then he pulled out the picture and he showed it to the people, and all the Africans in the church started laughing. And they laughed and they laughed and they laughed. And the missionary couldn't figure out, why in the world are they laughing? What he didn't realize was that all the people in the picture who were in hell were white. And sometimes we deceive ourselves by thinking the world is perfect and there's no room for improvement. Once upon a time, there were frogs who lived in a well. And this young girl would come and dip the bucket into the well, and the frogs would have to scatter so they wouldn't be picked up, because this was the perfect world, living in a well. That was great. And then one time, one of the frogs jumped into the bucket as it was being pulled up and went all the way to the top and hopped out when the woman took the bucket to go back to her place. And the frog saw light, really, for the first time, and saw the world around it for the first time. And so it went over to the well and looked down, and it says, it's great up here! It's great up here! And all the frogs down below said, baloney! Baloney! It's great down here! Well, a couple days later, the young girl came and threw her bucket into the well, and when she was pulling it up, it weighed way more than it normally did. And when it got to the top, it was filled with all these frogs who wanted to see a new world, a world better than the world they knew. Sometimes we get so used to doing things and so used to our routine that we don't realize the effect we have on others. There was a young girl whose mom was an anchor woman on a television program. And she used to watch the news every night for her mom. And then when the news was over, she'd wait for mom to come home and they'd have dinner. And one night, she said to her mom, "Mom, how come you always smile on the news?" And she said, "Because I'm paid to smile on the news, honey. That's why I smile." Oh. And the girl said to mom, "Mom, how much would I have to pay you to have you smile at home?" Sometimes we feel the urge to do what is right, but we realize that maybe it's not the right thing to do at this point. There was a nun who was visiting the Vatican at one time. And she started talking to her neighbor. And when she talked to the neighbor, she started getting this really bad feeling. Something's wrong with this guy, she thought. And so she talked to him, and she was as nice as she could be, but something was wrong with this guy. And then she thought, I should go to a Vatican guard and tell him something's wrong with this guy. But she realized, well, there's no way I can go to a Vatican guard and say something's wrong with this guy because I have no evidence that something's wrong with him. It's just sort of my gut feeling. Gut. That's it. I'm a gut person, see? So this is on the three types of the Enneagram. So she didn't do anything. And then a couple days later, she heard that Pope John Paul II had been shot. And she was shocked, and then she was happy to know that he hadn't been injured that badly. And then she looked in the paper, and they had a picture of the man who shot John Paul II. It was the guy that she had bad feelings about. A true story. A true story. All my stories are true, as I keep saying, but some are historically true. Okay, hearers and doers of the word, 147 on my sheet of text. Hearers and doers of the word. Everyone then who hears these words of mine and acts on them will be like a wise man who built his house on rock. The rain fell, the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house. But it did not fall, because it had been founded on rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act on them will be like a foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat against the house, and it fell. And great was its fall. Now when Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority, and not as their scribes had taught. So hearers and doers of the word. Sometimes we don't become a hearer of the word because we procrastinate. There's a short story about Diogenes and Alexander the Great. And Alexander the Great came to Diogenes one time and he said to Diogenes, "You know, I'd really like to become a philosopher like you. You are so good and so brilliant." And Diogenes says, "Well, stay with me and become a philosopher." And Alexander says, "No, I have people to conquer and places to go. Well, you can stay with me and become a philosopher. Alexander the Great said, no, it's not my time to become a philosopher. Maybe in my next life. Now think about what would have happened to the world had Alexander the Great, who conquered so many people, become a philosopher instead of a warrior. And then I have a favorite story about those who follow the word and sacrifice to follow the word. A true story, historically true. Rhiannon was a beautiful young woman, and she worked for the queen. And she loved working for the queen, and she loved the queen, and she really wanted to be the queen. And when the queen died, Rhiannon was just totally shaken up. And she got more into Zen Buddhism, and she decided that she wanted to become a Zen, whatever monkess is. She wanted to join the monastery of Zen. And when she told that to her friends, they said, no, 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 you've got to get married and have children. So Rhiannon knew that her family was against her and that she'd never get out on her own. And so she said, okay, I'll marry. And after I have my third child, I will enter the monastery. So she married this man, and she let it be known that after the third child, she would enter the monastery. And so it finally came to the point where she had her third child, and right after she recuperated from the birth and felt strong enough, she told her husband, I'm leaving to join the monastery. And she went to one monastery, and they looked at her, and they said, there's no way you can become a nun. You're too beautiful. And she went to another monastery and they said the same thing to her. And she didn't know how to become a nun. She knew that's what she was supposed to become. So finally she came up with a very harsh solution. She started a fire. She took a stick. She put the wood into the fire and got it hot. And she blew out the fire, but the stick was hot. And she put the stick to her face, both sides of her face, so that her face was totally, totally scarred. When she recuperated from the wounds, she went to a Zen monastery and said, I want to become a nun. And they let her in. This is a true story. And after they let her in, she wrote these words. As a handmaid of my empress, I burnt incense to give fragrance to my lovely clothes. Now, as a homeless beggar, I burned my face to enter the world of Zen. Okay. I'm going to read to you now, if that's all right. This is kind of my personal reflection on the Sermon on the Mount. Is that okay? But I have to begin with a story. Mm-hmm. The story is that each of us is called to conversion, and not just once, but constantly in our lives. And so the story here is another historically true story. A man who used to be bishop and retired of the Cathedral of Notre Dame in Paris once told the following story. One day there was a man who used to stand outside of the church of Notre Dame. And when people would come to go to Mass, he would heckle them. "Oh, you think you need God in your life? You're not strong enough to stand on your own two feet? How come you're so weak? What's wrong with you?" And he'd do this all the time, just pester the people as they started to come into the church. Well, the parish priest at that time just thought, "This is ridiculous." And so he decided, "I'm going to do something about it." So one time he went up to the young man outside and he said to the young man, "I have a challenge for you. And I know since you're the kind of person you are, you won't accept a challenge." "Oh, I'll take any challenge you want." "Then come with me into the church." So the priest brought the young man into the church and they went up to the front of the church. And as you probably know, most Catholic churches have crucifixes, not just crosses, but crucifixes. So with Jesus hanging on the cross. And the priest said to the young man, "Okay, what I want you to do is to look at the crucifix up there and say the following three times. Jesus died on the cross for me, and I don't care one bit." So the guy started, "Jesus died on the cross for me, and I don't care one bit." Two more times, the priest said, "Jesus died on the cross for me, and I don't care one bit." Third time, the priest said. He couldn't say it the third time. After the bishop told the story, he turned to the people he was talking to and he says, "I was that young man." Now, if I may read, kind of in summary here, we got 10 minutes to try and get through it, 15. Kind of the different parts of the sermon. The Beatitudes. The Beatitudes are calls to conversion. In fact, the whole sermon lets us know how much we have to change to truly be Christ-like. When I pray over the Beatitudes and how I live them out, I realize how challenging they are. Yes, I can admit that I need God in my life, poor in spirit. But am I open enough to let God direct my life? I want to experience the feelings of others, mourn, but I also know that I'm sometimes afraid to enter into their feelings. I think I'm approachable, meek, but I also know that I often withdraw from others. I do yearn for justice in our world, yearn for righteousness, but too often I do not get involved to bring justice about. I also try to be merciful, but I'm often overwhelmed by all the calls for help that I receive. I get at least one letter a day, I bet you do too, from some organization that wants me to help. I do not have the resources to help them all, so often I do nothing. I want to have an open mind and a spirit like children, pure in heart. But I also feel that I will be taken advantage of. I want to be a peacemaker, especially in our present world, which is filled with hatred and war. But I do not know where to begin. And no, I still do not want to suffer persecution for righteousness' sake. But I know that if I follow the path of Jesus, there will be obstacles and pain. I believe in the Beatitudes, but I have a long way to go to live them out. Salt and light. Salt and light speak to me of service and witnessing. As I said when I spoke of blessed are the merciful, there seems to be too much to do, and I get overwhelmed. I want to help, I want to be of service, but sometimes I do not know where to begin. I decided that the best way to serve is to use the talents God has given me, and I decided my greatest talent is teaching. Consequently, I've been involved in adult education for over 20 years. I love it. But I'm noticing that as I grow older, my energy level is diminishing. I also serve on a few committees at my parish, but I wonder how helpful I really am. But I do know this. I want to serve as best I can for as long as I can. We are all witnesses, some more than others. The way most people know about Christ is through the lives of others. About 46 years ago, I made a retreat at Sheridan, Oregon, just south of Portland. The retreat master was a Jesuit missionary from Alaska. Strangely enough, I remember, I who forget more and more, four words from the retreat. The retreat master said that when he came home every night, he would say the following four words. They're in Latin. Manifestavi nomen tuum hominibus. I have made your name known to my fellow human beings. That's why I've written this book. If one person comes closer to Jesus because of what I have written, then my work will not have been in vain. I pray that this is so. The Law and the Gospel. What do you want to be remembered for? These words have haunted me for a day. I certainly do not want to be remembered for my drinking days and what I did then. I do not even want to be remembered as a good teacher and a great storyteller, although these are important to me. I want to be remembered as a kind, compassionate, and loving person. That's what's important to me. Years ago, Alfred Nobel awoke to read his own obituary in the newspaper. The editors had confused a man named Nobel, who had died, with Alfred. Alfred read about how he was the father of dynamite. This was not what he wanted to be remembered for. So he set up a trust to fund the Nobel Peace Prize. And that's how we remember him. This section of the gospel points us away from the ordinary to the extraordinary. We would all like to be remembered for living out the words of Jesus, to be the ones who went out of our way to be reconciled, to be pure and devoted to one spouse, to be totally honest, to never seek revenge, but be willing to turn the other cheek and to love all people, even our enemies. We might like to be like this, but we also know how difficult it is. When I read this section of the sermon, I think of the motto of the Jesuits, Ad Maiorem Dei Gloriam, for the greater glory of God. There is always more that we can do. So I say to myself when I pray over these words that more can be done in love, in honesty, in relationships. I have further to travel on my journey to God. Almsgiving, prayer, and fasting. As I mentioned in the chapter on this, every time I've returned from Africa, I've been struck by how much Americans have and how much they think they need. And yet I do not see them any happier than the people I lived with in Africa. Each time I've returned, I've decided that I will live more simply. But my resolution quickly dissolves. I get caught up in acquiring more and more, except that does not mean that I acquire more and more happiness. I really do see a connection between fasting, letting go, and helping those who have less, almsgiving. But in spite of what I see, I never really follow that vision. How could I possibly give up some of my nativity sets, over 100, so that others might have food to eat or clothes to wear? I need the words of this part of the sermon to convert me so that they are not merely words, but a way of life. The same could be said about the words on prayer. Yes, prayer is listening, seeing, letting go, and speaking to God. I know this, but I have to let this be a core at the core of my life. St. Ignatius, the founder of the Jesuits, said that we are to find God in all things. The other day, as I was walking in my neighborhood, I saw a sign on a quote. I saw a quote on a sign outside a congregational church. It was from Julian of Norwich. The fullness of joy is to behold God in everything. How I long to do this. As I've often stated, my usual time to pray is when I walk. I think of this as a time to walk with Jesus. That's easy to say, but hard to do. I am easily distracted by what I see, what I think about, and what I hear. I try to refocus myself by letting each step become a prayer. And I actually do this to get a thing. When I'm walking, I go, God is here. I love you. Jesus is here. I love you. Spirit is here. I love you. And that gets me back to where I'm going. But then I find all kinds of other things that help me. My imagination plays all the time. I've decided, and I usually do my morning walk, it's about 45 minutes, and I go down the street behind me and then up to Volunteer Park in Seattle and around the reservoir and then around the ponds and then down to the conservatory and then back down. And it's about 45 minutes. And so some of the things along the walk are special. if I see a squirrel running across, I think of the Holy Spirit, because I think of the Holy Spirit as being playful and squirrels as being playful. It used to be that if I saw fish in the two ponds that are up at Volunteer Park, they would be signs that God was with me. Well, they had very few fish, and now they got all kinds of fish, and so now I know God is all around me. And I don't look for signs of Jesus because I'm usually wearing a cross. And then I have certain trees that become blessing trees. And when I feel I'm walking under the tree, I feel I'm being blessed by God. There's one tree that's on the way to church, and when I walk under it, it's my special blessed tree. But I keep adding blessing trees. And then on the way back from Africa this last 2 weeks ago or something, I stayed at Gonzaga High School outside of, in Dublin, and they had this huge, huge, round tree that was just unbelievable. I have no idea what kind it was, and it was just starting to turn colors. And that became my blessing tree in Africa. Singleness of purpose. How easy it is to say that I have one goal in life, but how hard it is to live it. I can say that Jesus is my treasure, that I prefer God over wealth, that I have one vision that I hope to follow. Words, words, words. How do I live out that vision or relish that treasure or preference? The words of Anthony de Mello come again to mind, the de Mello I've talked about before. The enlightened know that to make the world a painless place, you need to change your heart, not the world. Obviously, I'm not enlightened. Relationships. As I've mentioned often, my favorite way of praying is to meditate while I walk. I like to think of this as walking with Jesus. As I've also mentioned, I'm easily distracted. So, I've come up with things that will help me refocus. I've talked about the ones that I had before, my feet and so forth. One of these is the wind. When I feel a breeze against my face, I feel that I am being touched by the Holy Spirit. And this is the image from the last chapter. And believe it or not, it looks kind of like me. My son-in-law did it. But I actually walk like this. For some reason, I walk with my hands behind my back. I think probably to get my shoulders back and keep my back from hurting. But that's the picture he drew there. Relationships. Okay. And the image of the wind is a good image for spirit because it's also the idea of the wind coming over things to organize the chaos in the book of Genesis. As I reflect on the last chapter, the conclusion of the sermon, two things strike me. How easy it is to deceive oneself, and how important it is to have a solid foundation. I worry about self-deceit because I've deceived myself so often. All I can do in prayer is try to be honest, have the courage to talk to others. So often my friends, my wife, even students see me more honestly than I see myself. The road to self-knowledge often lies through others, and we need the humility and courage to hear and understand what they say. I like to think that I have a solid foundation because I believe that Jesus is that rock upon which I have based my life. I know that I can be deceived here too, but I try to make Jesus my foundation. I do this primarily through prayers. There's not a day that goes by when I do not pray that I will see him more clearly, love him more dearly, follow him more nearly. Sound like a song you've heard? Writing this book has, I believe, made me more aware of him. I have certainly prayed more and thought more about him. But I also pray that each person who reads what I have written will see Jesus in a new and more meaningful way. If this happens even to only one person, then my efforts will not have been in vain. May you be free from self-deception and come to take Jesus as your Lord and teacher. Amen.